And I am going to say that it is 9:20, and this is Wendy Edelberg, and it's an interview of Larry Lindsay.
Great. And do you have a group of people there, or?
It's actually just me.
Okay.
I think it's the Monday Gremlin again.
Got it. That's fine.
But
I'm just curious.
And my special assistant Shaista Ahmed is actually here as well, taking some notes too.
Okay.
As backup, and people have fed me their questions that we want to make sure we ask you about.
All right. Fair enough.
I have a whole set of questions around, you know, reaching back in time from when you were a Fed governor.
Yep.
One of the things that we have thought a lot about is the changes in the financial system over time, and whether or not any of those changes mattered for why we had a financial crisis, whether it was changes in, you know, the shadow banking system or the parallel banking system, or, you know, use of short-term funding markets, money market mutual funds, all that stuff. We've been thinking hard about if there are any of those changes that, or regulatory changes, any of those changes that we should be thinking about in our investigation. One broad question I have for you is, what did you think of, did you see changes in the financial system during that time when you were a Fed governor? Did you make anything of them? And in retrospect, do you make anything of them?
Sure. But if I could just put it in a slightly larger context.
Yeah.
I think that the right way to look at what happened is not any particular institutional change, but rather we've had lots of these crises in history, and the dynamics always tend to be the same. And it is that the social and political forces really, really like a boom and are pro-cyclical on the way up. And they don't like the way down very much, but they are pro-cyclical on the way up. And I think that's really the context in which we should be examining this. So I must put myself down just on an economic historical basis as a skeptic that we can make institutional changes that will, quote, prevent this the next time, because I think we'll find that the political and social dynamic will do just what it did this last time, which is exacerbate the upside. Extrapolating that to the institutional changes of the 90s, one area where I was involved because of my job had to do with the expansion of home ownership opportunities. And I think that the institutional changes that were brought about in that area were a contributing factor. They weren't the main factor, but they were a contributing factor to what ultimately happened. We were. Should I go on? Should I just talk?
Please. Yes.
Okay. I think again, this is that we all have the advantage of 20/20 hindsight now, but. Beginning in 1993, the regulatory structure was under a lot of pressure to increase the supply of funds going to low and moderate income communities, particularly in the area of housing. And I was assigned by Chairman Greenspan to be the governor in charge of community and consumer affairs, and I ultimately became the chairman of the Neighborhood Reinvestment Corporation, which oversaw neighborhood housing services. And so I I ended up being quite active in this area. I think there was a market flaw that it was important to correct. And I think the market flaw basically was a standard public goods problem that when you think about the value of any one property, it is not only the factors involved in that property, but also the neighborhood in which the property is located. And so consequently, if an individual or if a financial institution were to invest heavily in a single property in what was otherwise a depressed area, they would not get the return. They wouldn't get a return on capital. And so, you know, you get a standard public goods kind of market failure. And the way we saw to redress that was through an expansion, and I would call it more of a quantification of the existing Community Reinvestment Act, which essentially put, I would call it a soft quota on loans to mortgage loans in particular to low and moderate income areas.
Well, actually, can I interrupt you for one
sure.
second? So if so, because this is something I know a little bit about, you know, if I totally agree that the Community Reinvestment Act became, you know, more quantitatively, or I think this is where you were going, more quantitatively enforced in the mid-90s. But before we get too deep into the Community Reinvestment Act, do you think that, broadly speaking, loans made to households in Community Reinvestment Act assessment areas for the purpose of getting CRA credit were causal in the crisis?
They were, but not directly. And let me just, if I can just play the music forward a little bit.
Sure.
You know, again, there was a market failure, and the original CRA rules corrected that market failure, and the increased flow of funds into low and moderate income areas did boost house prices in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the rise in house prices, of course, as would always do, depressed losses. You know, you rarely get a foreclosure on a house that's not underwater. And so the success rate of lending in these areas increased. And both the banking industry, the shadow banking industry, and the regulators took note of this. And so that made the case for even more lending in low and moderate income areas, which of course put more money into those areas, which sustained a very low loss rate. And we basically got a cycle going, which particularly the shadow banking industry could, using recent historic data, show that default rates on this type of lending were very, very low. And that helped justify credit standards. You also had the regulator, and I'm again, it's been a long time, and I'm late middle age, so I'm finding a lot of brain cells have died, so please forgive me if I have the name wrong. As I recall, that by 2001, it was might have been FHA, had a 55% requirement on loans. It may have been Fannie, I've forgotten. 55% of loans had to go to low and moderate income areas, and then there was a very low income quota as well. So the quotas were being ratcheted up, and the justification for it was, you know, here was, you know, very low default rates, so why weren't loans going into these areas?
Right. So just to because I've been looking at these. I think what you have in mind is the affordable housing goals that Fannie and Freddie faced.
Yes,
and
that's it.
And those went over 50%. Well in the middle of the housing boom in, say, I think 2004 is when they made it over 50%.
Okay. Whatever the data, the point is to show the causality here. And the self-reinforcing nature of how societies and regulators and financial institutions extrapolate from experience and therefore take what began as sort of a very sound corrective behavior to levels that really are not economically justified. Because, again, what happened at the beginning and the reason for the success at the beginning was that when you first address a market failure, obviously, you're going to get a very positive feedback. But after the market failure is addressed and you get up to a level where you get those very, very high quotas we were talking about, you've gone beyond mere addressing of the market failure and you're actually challenging. I mean, if you would step back about it and you think about having 55% of all mortgages go to low and moderate income areas, that's an extraordinary number. And I understand how the policy process got there. And I understand that at any given point in time, you could have, you could justify it based on trailing 5 years of experience with it,
right?
Because you were in a bubble. I mean, you were literally right. in a feedback loop where more and more money was chasing fewer and fewer opportunities.
No, that's right. So the affordable housing goals at Fannie and Freddie were actually set. It's interesting. They were actually set really truly on this backward looking screen. And it was based on what was the market that Fannie and Freddie was serving. And if they were trying to serve a market that was looking, you know, that was actually the mortgage market that was out there in the peak of the housing boom, that market looked darn near like more than 50% was low and moderate income. So, I think to make different affordable housing goals, you would have been getting into the nature of you actually need to be serving a different market than what, you know, the average lender out there is serving. They would have actually been fighting against the market. Does that make sense?
First of all, why were they putting the target on?
Oh, well, right, because they public purpose.
But again, I think, please, let's not get into the weeds. I'm not criticizing anyone's decision. Remember, I was at the start of this, right? What I'm pointing out, though, a fair question would be, what you just said was, this is what the market looked like. Well, why did the market look that way?
Yeah.
Was it entirely divorced from the fact that more and more money had been fed into these areas? I mean, it would be very hard to find long-term historical precedent for that scale of the mortgage market going into low and moderate income housing.
Yep.
It really would. I mean, so, and it was not just the goals. First of all, I understand why the goals were put in. I'm not arguing against the position, and I understand why people securitized all those loans and everything. But when you see a ratcheting up like that of money being channeled into any area, be it tulips or, you know, South Sea India Company, the South, whatever it was, East India Company. I'm just back from Tokyo, so I'm a little bit jet lagged. Or whatever it may be, that is usually something that accompanies a bubble.
Right.
And it was at the very least politically impossible to challenge, to make that observation. It was obvious to everyone what was happening who was actually involved in the movement to encourage affordable housing, that, you know, we were overdoing things here. But because there was the original success of affordable housing efforts involved very intense work with the borrowers. I mean, that's what neighborhood housing services did. We were delivering product on a scale that went way beyond what was what could have been envisioned in, say, the early 1990s. And so I think that was part of what fed the boom.
So should I be then paying very close attention to the home ownership rate? I mean, if were these policies attempting to increase home ownership?
Of course, and there's nothing wrong with that, and I'm all for it.
Right.
You know?
I
think the bigger picture is not the fact that in this case it was a target of increasing home ownership, which was a bipartisan supported program. It is that when you start to get something moving up, whatever it may be, and as a result, because more money is going into that something, it looks like it is successful, that attracts more money, and that is the... that leads to, it's really a linear extrapolation problem. Most decision making is done on a linear extrapolation of recent behavior. And so wherever it is you see, a linear extrapolation says we go to the moon, it could have been tech stocks, right? We went through this in tech stocks as well. It is likely to continue. And the way societies are geared and the way private sector and public sector decision making is geared is to feed the boom. Again, the previous bubble had been tech stock. Chairman of the Fed could say irrational exuberance. In fact, the reaction to the irrational exuberance speech is another great example. Greenspan had to back off after that speech because the political reaction, not just in Washington, but in the banking community and everywhere else, was really, really adverse. And, you know, it's sort of, how dare you take away our bubble from us, right? I don't care what the product is, whether it's tech or whether it's mortgages. That's just the way the political process operates. It's the way the private sector decision-making process operates. It's the way the human mind works. And I think we saw that in play.
So I definitely have tech stock bubble, is it? I don't know, I've mixed up the words. Questions for you. But before we move off of housing, how do I put in context that home ownership rates peaked in 2004?
2004?
Yeah.
What was it in 2007?
So, let's see. I will now, with the power of Google, I will look. But basically, they peaked at about 65%. Let me see.
I thought we got to 67.5. But
I'm sure you're right. I think I am sure you're right. Let's see. I'm going to do this in real time. So I know that they peaked in 2004 and then failed to continue to rise. So let's see. So in 2004, 69.2%. So yeah, I was way off.
Wow.
And then, but in 2005, ticked down to just 69, in 2006 ticked down to 68.9. In 2007, like down again to 67.8. And it's just continued down. So if this is a housing boom being pushed by policies to try and increase home ownership, what did something, is it, how do I square that with home ownership not actually rising?
Well, why were the extra mortgages being given? Why in 2007 was there a record share of subprime mortgages being offered?
They were refinancings. They were the same homeowners just refinancing. It wasn't about getting them into homes.
Oh, okay. But again, why was that process created? Because in getting you got the people into homes, what was the deal being offered? Look, sign on for the mortgage, and you can always refinance later.
Right.
All right. So, in that sense, that was how it was sort of the aftershock of the move to get everyone into a house.
Right. Right. And then
in most of those mortgages, I'm sure, in 2004 were ARMs or, relatively short term.
No, that may be. I guess I'm trying to.
I mean, why were people refinancing?
Well, certainly.
They got a better deal, right?
Well, or to take cash out.
Or to take cash out, right. So, and one of the things that was relaxed was that in order to get all this done was the down payment. I mean, the loan-to-value ratio.
Right.
It used to be 80%.
Right.
Why were the standards liberalized? Standards were liberalized in order to increase volume.
Right.
Qualify more people.
And
it was profitable. Why was it profitable? Profitable because more and more money was pouring into that market.
So talk more about that. Why was it profitable?
Yeah, I'm thinking you're trying to think I'm criticizing the move, the policy move. I'm not criticizing the policy move. What I'm saying is that whatever market you want to pick, when you have a surge of money going into it and it appears that it's a profitable area, generically, that's a very, very tough thing to stop. Because the regulators won't notice it. The private sector won't notice it. I'll stop there. I'm just saying that it's an automatic kind of fee into why we get into the troubles we get into.
And so you mentioned the tech bubble, right?
Right.
So the loss of wealth from the tech bubble bursting was
right.
About the same order of magnitude as the loss of wealth from the housing bubble bursting.
Right. And you had a much more timely reaction.
Yes.
You had, I mean, I wrote this in my book, so you can go there if you want, but the we knew the tech bubble was going to burst. You can read the minutes of the Fed meetings, right before I left, and I was saying, don't do this because you're going to create a bubble. After the bubble was created, the question was, what do you do? And Greenspan famously said, 1929 did not cause 1933. It depends what you do in 30 and 31. So what we did in 30 and 31 was what, the textbook said, which is cut taxes or stimulate and cut interest rates. And we did. And we did it very early in the cycle. And as a result, we got away with a very minor recession. And if you look at the wealth to income chart, we bottomed out at the long-term historic average. We never went below average, and then we just started up again.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very timely response. I don't think you got the kind of cleansing you would have gotten. The extra stimulus, in hindsight, ultimately went into feeding a second bubble.
And why not so successful after the housing bubble burst?
I don't think the response was very timely, and I think it was much less efficient.
So, I mean,
I think it's particularly on the fiscal side, but on the um, you know, I don't think the money went to the places it should go in order to deal with what was a balance sheet problem.
Among households or financial institutions?
Mostly among, I continue to think the issue is a household issue. And I think we made a mistake, and I said so at the time, by focusing on preserving financial institutions.
So you don't point to, this is interesting, so you wouldn't point to one of the reasons that the bursting of the housing bubble had a larger effect than the bursting of the tech bubble. You don't point to the fact that the financial institutions were, the financial system had, you know, that there was a credit bubble using those assets to create
there was
leverage.
A credit bubble also in 2000. I mean, a lot of the money that went into tech, we think of it as equity, but it was actually financial institution financed loans to, you know, nouveau financial intermediaries, be it hedge funds or private equity firms. Now, they were able, they had to liquidate and get and pay back, and they could more easily because the loans were callable rather than mortgages, which generally were not. But I think the main difference, I think both were credit finance.
So in terms of things that weren't primary, in terms of, I just want to then sort of take some things off the list. In terms of, of things that were not primary in the reason that the housing bubble bursting had such disastrous effects, it sounds like you would say that the system was really no more fragile in 2008 than it was in 2001 or 2000.
Well, I think different parts of the system were fragile. What we learned in 2001, 2002 was that corporate finance was extremely fragile. And you had to, you had to have a lot of restructuring there, and I think it took place. The big surprise came to me in 2002 when you began to get the lagged effects of the ERISA rules hitting the pension funds, and we were in danger of having most of the free cash flow of the corporate sector going into funding pensions rather than into business plant equipment investment. That would have aborted any chance of recovery. And I think one of the reasons for the dividend and capital gains tax cuts was, in fact, to give a bit of a breather on the pension fund side.
And what parts of the system in 2008 do you think were fragile? Because I think you said that they were fragile in different ways.
Yeah, well, no, I think maybe you had... whoever the holders of the long-term, the mortgage paper was, I think they were the ones who were in trouble. And probably that may have been disproportionately banks. I don't think that was necessarily the case if, you know, early on in the process, but it certainly turned out to be later on. It was, looking back on it, I'm trying to label it, is it would be the securitizers, right, who were the most fragile.
Well, so to the extent that some of them had, you know, billions of dollars of assets stuck in their pipelines, yes.
That's where the fragility, you know, can I just, again, this sort of a how we never learn kind of story, which is the one thing that I think I'd like to convey. In the previous housing bubble, which I joined the Fed for just in time for, we you know, we did not have securitization, and we had what banks held the stuff on their own books, and you know, which we now sometimes think of as a good thing. We didn't at the time, because what happened then was that you had regional concentration, and if you had a regional downturn, a regional real estate downturn, it took down the banks in that region along with it, which exacerbated the downturn. So we said to ourselves, how on earth do we get around this problem? And the answer was, let's just have national securities markets so we don't have regional concentration. You know, and so it was intentional. You know, fast forward, it was probably, you know, I don't know what conclusions you're reaching, but I think a lot of people have the view that the securitization, that change in the incentive structure probably exacerbated the problem.
Well, that's certainly something that we're very much looking into. I mean, though that's always puzzling, right, as an economist, because investors are supposed to understand adverse selection. And they're, right?
Yeah, okay.
You know, they're supposed to price for it. I mean, that wasn't supposed to be a shock, right?
Remember we just talked about why adverse selection wasn't priced for, right? When you pour more and more, you know, everyone thought you'd be having adverse selection, right? But hey, it wasn't there, right? Defaults were going
right.
down.
Right? No, and I think that's right. But, I mean, the other part about securitization is that it seems, and I'd love to get your reaction to this, that, you know, okay, so you mentioned, you know, policymakers thinking that securitization or regulators thinking securitization is a good thing because it's going to get some of the risk off of banks' balance sheets. It seems like as then people were watching the securitization markets grow, they just continued to believe that securitization was diversifying the risk. It was getting...
Right, I know.
And so by...
It was diversifying the risk, but it wasn't reducing the risk. And that was one of the big confusions of the time. For, you know, if again, it goes back to, you know, the public goods issue. You as an individual can diversify your risk. The system as a whole, though, cannot reduce the risk. And that's where the confusion lies.
Yep. Well, that, and I would say it would seem it really wasn't diversifying the risk as much as we think.
But that gets back to the problem that you were moving a regional risk into a national risk, right? And you couldn't. For a while, there are gains in that. There's no question that the national securitization market was a more diversified risk than the regional market. But as you just pointed out, as you move more and more from regional to national, you get less and less diversification in the process.
Right. But I guess I'm also just making the maybe more banal point that institutions that, you know, on the face of it seemed actually to be laying off risk, you know, take Citi, for example, actually were incredibly exposed to the exact same risks through indirect off-balance sheet entities
right.
and stuff
right.
like that. So it turns out they really weren't diversifying the risk.
They really weren't. That's right.
And
the other thing, if I can, and again, my general view is that it's not a particular institution; it's a society-wide dysfunction. If I can point at the economics profession, you remember the term "Great Moderation"?
I sure do.
Well, what had we done? We had convinced ourselves that we were in a less risky world, and how should any rational investor? Respond to a less risky world. They should lay on more risk.
And I mean, where do you lay that at the feet of the Greenspan put? Do you lay that just at we were looking at, you know, less volatility historically in the very recent data?
But that's the same story as was true It's a linear extrapolation problem, isn't it? It was true in low-income housing. It was true in tech. If you do any linear extrapolation of where these things are going, you're going to go to the moon. And that was the same thing. I really put it down, if you want to think about why there's a financial crisis ever and why there's a bubble ever, it ultimately comes down to hubris. And I think we economists were guilty of hubris.
When we think about, you know, one of the terms that some of us throw around here that make other people really mad is you know, the underpricing of risk or the mispricing of risk. They say that people who aren't economists say that's a completely meaningless phrase.
Because, of course, what do they believe? That, of course, markets price it correctly?
No, because what they're saying is, you know, it wasn't being, like, well, I guess what it does is it leads to this question, I think, which is, were people, did they have the wrong distribution in mind that they were pricing off of? Or, which suggests, say, or was it the wrong distribution? Or was it the right distribution but the mispricing? And I think that that's why they don't like the phrase mispricing. It suggests that everybody had the right expectations, but we were all just mispricing it.
I see. No, I would be on the side that we had the wrong expectations.
Right. And that the prices made perfect sense based on that distribution.
People were being irrational, right? They were being told by everybody, right, that risk, we were entering a less risky world.
So
that moved the distribution. It was
right.
The wrong distribution.
And but why?
But that's societal wide, right? It's not anyone's fault.
Well, there certainly weren't. There were some people screaming and yelling and jumping up and down, saying that the housing market in particular had become incredibly out of whack.
Yeah, I was one of them. But believe me, it was a very lonely world.
And did you foresee, I apologize, like if this is the title of something that you've written that I should have read.
That's right.
But did you foresee that the bursting of the housing bubble would cause such calamitous results?
Not. I think it was beyond. I don't think I had. I think it would be bad, but I don't think it would be as bad as it was.
So what happened that was so surprising? I mean, I guess we've talked about it a little bit, that maybe it's because securitization didn't diversify the risk as much as people thought.
Oh, I think the response to it was poor. The policy response was very poor. That's my judgment about. I think we made a lot of mistakes.
And so housing prices peaked.
Mainly because it started with denial.
So housing prices peak in, let's say, 2006. You know, you start seeing subprime lenders go under at the end of that year. When should the policy response have been aggressive? When should it have kicked in aggressively?
Well, the real answer is 1998 and 2001. But I know that's somewhat facetious. I think that it should have started probably in 2006. I mean, at that point, you know, what we were hearing was things are well contained. Remember that phrase?
I really do.
They really were not, and you know, I think that we were still in hubris mode, and we were very slow to the party.
So I think one of the reasons...
I'll give you an example. This is in the public domain. The New York Times actually had a story on it. You know, I went into the White House in late 05 and again in early 06, and I said, look, guys, you're about to have the thing burst. House bubble's about to burst. At the very least, set up a committee to monitor it. Monitor what's going on so that, you know, you can be ready to pull the emergency switch when you have to. And they chose not to. And they chose not to because they thought I was being an alarmist. And Hank Paulson was one of those arguing against the need for it. You know, it's just, it's again, the process was really, really, didn't want to believe. Much as the Clinton White House didn't want to believe that you were having a collapse and that you were in the middle of a bubble.
It seems that one of the reasons that Bernanke made that famous comment is because, and I certainly came into this job with this thought, it seems like people at the Fed, regulators, policymakers, had been listening to the institutions themselves who thought that the subprime crisis would be contained.
How about the economics profession?
But did we, I guess my broader question is, did people like Chairman Bernanke and others have a system in place to be able to answer that question differently? Did we have the access to information? I mean, you
yes.
saw the inklings, but so
yes, I think it was obvious to anyone looking at a chart that we were in a bubble.
Oh no! And I suspect. I mean, certainly that debate was hot and heavy. I mean, I don't know that. If you had said, I think we're in a housing bubble in 2006, there are lots of people who would not have said, you know, who would have agreed with you. Lots and lots and lots of people, I think. I mean, the Economist, what is it, the picture in the front of the Economist, I can't remember, 2005, 2006, after the fall with the brick falling down, you know, the end of the housing bubble bursting. You know, it would not shock you to know that the Federal Reserve was perpetually running scenarios of what happens when house prices fall. And still with all of that, the analysis was the subprime crisis is contained. And, you know, if you look at some, you know, even Citigroup itself was telling investors that they only had a little over $10 billion in exposure to the subprime market until, you know, a couple weeks later, they said, actually, it's $55 billion that we have an exposure.
Right.
It seems like institutions themselves didn't know.
They didn't. No, that's right.
And so how could regulators have known? I guess what I'm saying is, let me ask the question a little bit differently. You go to Paulson, let's say you also went to Chairman Bernanke, and you say, there's a housing bubble, it's going to burst, and it's going to be bad. And maybe they even said to you, or what if they had said to you at the time, don't worry, if it bursts, it'll be contained. Did you have evidence to point to at the time that it wouldn't be?
Well, you really never know that, do you? I think that I did have conversations with Chairman Bernanke, and I think the lesson of them was the one that I took away from what happened in 91, 92. And that was that things tend to go further than you want, in part because of the regulatory reaction. I mean, the financial system and the regulatory system tend to be countercyclical. Excuse me, tend to be pro-cyclical because you, with a lag, adjust capital. As you adjust capital, you become more risk-averse, and the increased risk aversion and reduced lending exacerbates the problem. And the regulatory structure tends to layer on top of that. And that's why you always tend to overshoot. I don't think there's anything you can do to correct that.
So just patterns in history would have suggested that when the housing bubble burst, it was going to be bad.
Yes. I mean one of my favorite charts is the wealth-to-income ratio. And the wealth-to-income ratio has a well-established historic mean, and we got way off that historic mean. And you know you're going to return to that historic mean. And we did. We'll see if we overshoot it this time. But we did much like we did in 2001, 2002. Except the bubble got bigger the second time.
And so when Secretary Geithner says that one of the primary things that went wrong is that they relied on the spare tire. They relied on that, you know, in previous crises, the traditional banking sector and the shadow banking sector were able to help each other. And that's one of the things that mitigated shocks. I don't want to put words in your mouth. What do you think about that theory?
I don't know. I don't have an opinion. I don't know.
And how did you see the relationship between those two sectors changing over time when you were in a, you know, either at the White House or at the Fed? Or did you?
Well, again, the shadow banking sector was part of the securitization process, right? That was the key to it. And so I think it was generally viewed as a good thing. Remember, I think we talk about extra legs to the stool. There's a lot of rhetoric about that. I think that was how it was phrased. Seemed quite plausible. What I don't think was appreciated was that they were codependent. I think we probably missed that.
That these two sectors became codependent on each other.
Right.
Yep. But and in fact, the traditional banking sector became, you know, very much involved in securitization. I mean, so
yes, that's right. Yeah, they all became incestuous, didn't they?
Right. So coming back to housing, you had pointed to policy as one of the things that spurred lenders on to, you know, be making loans to low and moderate income borrowers. And let's see if I can summarize. And then you would say that as making loans to these borrowers, they discovered that these loans could be profitable. And would you say then that created basically the machinery to do it and the history that they now had behind them to say maybe it's not such a bad idea? Yep.
And the most important element in all this is that it's a self-reinforcing cycle. That once you start pushing money into an area, it will attract more money and more money and more money because it will. When you have any kind of reallocation, the area that money is being reallocated in will be the relative outperformer. And the nature of momentum trading is to follow the relative outperformance. And so that's what's going to tend to overdo it.
But in addition to policy, how much weight would you put on other factors like technology, FICO scores, automated underwriting, those sorts of things?
Well, back in the day, when FICO scores, we first had credit scoring models. It's a funny story. It's just a personal story, but it sort of gets to your point. I had been a critic of exclusive reliance on credit scoring, in part because I thought that there's an element of judgment that in the process, and so I've been getting lots of speeches about this, and it was like a dog barking that no one listened to, and I had two young kids at the time and was a frequent shopper at Toys R Us.
Oh, I think I know this story.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I applied for a Toys R Us card.
I know this story.
And got turned down.
Yes.
And I called up and asked why, and they said, well, your score wasn't sufficient because you've got too many requests for your credit file. And I had, because I was refinancing, right? It was probably bringing interest rates down or something. I forget the details, but that's what it was for. And, here I am, not only a Fed governor, but I'm the, chairman of the Consumer Affairs Committee, right? So it's kind of a weird thing to do. So I called a friend of mine, Dave Westlow, at the Journal. And I said, I've got a funny story for you. And I told them the story, and they ran it. It was inside the back page story. But that's where you start, from the back. And immediately Toys R Us called me and said, oh, what kind of credit line do you want? Will you do anything you want? Of course, they said, I can't take your card anymore. Sorry, guys. But that actually got people to pay attention to the fact that computerization really wasn't the best way to do things, that you needed to instill judgment as well. And I would say that was true probably on the upside as well as on the downside. We were giving, with computerization, we were giving credit cards to people who shouldn't be getting credit cards. And, in a rising tide environment, the losses weren't observable until they got really, really bad. Well, I'm sympathetic to your point that maybe the technological changes took human judgment out of it.
But what I was thinking is what they did is they actually made it cheaper and so more profitable to make risky loans.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. That's true. Which we normally would think of as an unadulterated good thing, right?
Right.
Reduction in the cost of something, right? Makes it more accessible to everybody.
Right. So the other... It's interesting that you would point to policy failures and in being a primary cause of the crisis, and I'm guessing you mean not only...
It's a contributor. The thing is that I don't think there's a single cause. I think that most players in society tend to behave the same way in every bubble, which is they're believers on the upside.
But those policy failures, you would point to not just fiscal, but I assume also monetary policy, that it didn't...
Monetary and regulatory, right. Yeah. We should have hiked rates in 1996.
Right. So this is my question. So what role do you give to monetary policy from, post 2000, 2001 recession through 2008?
I think it's one of many factors. I think, especially in hindsight, the hiking should have been more rapid than it was. A quarter basis point of time. Here was the thinking, here's Greenspan's thinking, and I think the economics profession endorsed it, was that you provide when you provide certainty to the market, you get a better outcome. And Greenspan was providing certainty to the market. He said, we're going to raise rates a quarter point every meeting forever until we get there. Basically, for the rest of my term, is kind of the way it was. And that's what they did. And, we applauded the greater certainty, and the markets took off on the greater certainty. And normally we would think of that as a good thing, but actually we know that it also facilitated the expansion of the bubble. And so we economists need to look in the mirror and say, so is greater certainty the unambiguous good that we thought it was? And the answer is probably no.
And is this greater certainty just about the short end of the yield curve, or is this the Vince Reinhardt argument that you created a certainty about the steepness of the yield curve?
Probably both. I think one tends to drive the other.
If I understand his argument correctly, he would say the problem was gradualism, and that the Fed signaled that it was going to raise short-term interest rates, slowly and steadily, that markets priced that in immediately into the long end of the yield curve.
Right.
And then just slowly but surely, the yield curve got flatter and flatter, but in this incredibly predictable way, creating this desire to, you know, borrow short and lend long.
Lend long, right.
So you buy that.
I buy that.
Okay. And,
but it wasn't, you know, again, think about what Greenspan was doing. I think most of the economics profession would support his line of thinking. At the time he did it.
So this is really about, so the argument I just laid out is about short-term interest rates or the Fed's monetary policy changing the mix of investment, or, you know, changing the types of investments institutions do, rather than creating, you know, cheap money that somehow has an effect on global capital flows or something like that. Where do you put global capital flows? And just the, I don't know.
Well, that was part, again, that started in the early 90s as well. And, we made a set of institutional decisions, both here and in Tokyo, that were mainly foreign policy oriented, to encourage and facilitate China getting richer as a way of avoiding military conflict. And so we set it up that they were going to have trade surpluses, and that they was going to be recycled, and it just got a bit out of hand, right? And we never stopped. The system worked too well for everybody. But again, it was a policy decision that was made in the early 90s.
But I guess what I'm saying is, how important is the level of interest rates versus short-term versus the steepness of the yield curve? So the global capital flows seem to really affect the level of interest rates. So let's say there had been less money flowing in, and mortgage rates, instead of being, you know, instead of having a 3% 2/28 teaser rate, you would have had a 4% 2/28 teaser rate. Would that have been the difference between having a housing bubble and not having a housing bubble? I guess I'm trying to figure out, in terms of ranking, how primary was it having money coming in from abroad pushing down long-term interest rates?
You know, it was... my whole thinking is I can't assign blame to one factor, because I think it was all working together. I'm sorry, I can't help you as far as it was important. We would have, you know, if we had financial autarky, we never could have run it, right? So that's certainly true. So I think financial flows were a necessary condition for what happened. But are they? I can't assign a percentage, because I think it's a necessary condition. I don't think it's within. After you get there, do I think it was 27% or 42%? I don't know.
Right,
I can't judge that.
It's necessary, but it's not sufficient.
It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. That's correct.
And in terms of the things, I don't want to take too much more of your time, so you should just tell me if there's more things you want to tell me. But in terms of then sufficient, you know, so what actually was sufficient? It sounds like you would mostly say, from what you've talked about, it sounds like what you'd mostly say is the decline in underwriting standards, and then the ineffective or insufficient policy response were sufficient.
Well, because they were sufficient, but you need a catalyst too, right? You know, yeah, I think you've identified what I think were the two main drivers, yes.
Okay. That's very helpful. Is there more before, you've been incredibly generous with your time. Is there more that you want to make sure we know? Bad ideas that are out in the world that you want to make sure we know are bad ideas, or good ideas that you want to make sure we know are good ideas?
I think watching the regulatory reaction is always interesting too, because we're as we did on the upside, we are becoming pro-cyclical on the downside too.
So do you think, does that mean that you think that there was a deregulation on the upside played a role?
We'll see, but the regulators were singing from the same song sheet as the banks, right? I mean, that was one of the things you pointed out earlier. I go back to the observation, historical observation, that it's very hard to find a contrarian, that generally everyone sings the praises of the boom and are slow to respond on the downside.
So did regulators drop the ball?
Well, that's a common way of saying it. I don't know how, but I don't know if anyone drops anything. I mean, did they do something knowingly wrong? No. I mean, it's like the economics profession, right? I mean, the economics profession was wrong as well. The political process was wrong. 300 million greedy Americans were involved in this. I mean, it's very hard to be a contrarian, for anyone, even a regulator, to play a contrarian role on the upside or on the downside.
And we're not supposed to really be doing forward-looking stuff, or at least that's not our mandate, but is there a way to create a system so that regulators can be more contrarian?
One would wish that would be the case. History suggests that never works out that way. But one would certainly hope, it's like hoping for human perfectibility, right?
Well, there's certainly been, haven't there been times historically when regulators have been able to be more aggressive, getting their voices heard, being contrarian? No? Am I just being a Pollyanna?
Well, why don't you give me what you had in mind? Tell me what you had in mind.
Well, all right, so now that I've said it out loud, I don't know what I have in mind. I guess I'm...
Again, can I just say something off the record?
Yes. Well, all right. This has been really helpful. As we move into writing our report, these sorts of, interviews with people who can keep us on the right path and help us think about whether or not we need to course correct are immensely helpful. So I just want
to... I'll make a bet, though.
Yes?
What you got from me was quite contrarian, and I have very little expectation that that point of view is going to get into the report, but that's okay.
It absolutely gets into the mix of sharing it with staff.
I wasn't being critical. I really wasn't being critical. I didn't mean it critical. I'm very happy to help you out.
So thank you.
It's just sort of interesting the way these... my problem is I've been in and out of government now for 30 years, and so that's a scary thought. I've got a lot of cynical bones in my body.
Well, thank you. Thank you for all of your time.
You're very welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.